Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
Kyler Tsinis. I'm Kyler Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to Humans XF Manchester with me, Clint Boone. Every week we'll be celebrating the spirit of Manchester by talking to somebody who's helped shape the city. This week I'm joined by Alan Tong, ex-professional footballer, sports psychology lecturer and mental health FA ambassador. Alan describes what it was like as a youth team player in the early Alex Ferguson years.
It was tough culture. Yeah. You know, you had to clean boots, we had to sweep dressing rooms, we was painting training grounds. It wasn't as glamorous as maybe... It is certainly today. You know, it's changed a lot over this last 20, 25 years.
And he'll describe the heartbreak he felt after his career-ending injury.
Yeah, I was very lost for probably about 4 years. Clint lost, went through a series of jobs doing different things, you know, working in warehouses. I was working for the post office, signing up with agencies, stuff like that. Yeah. So anything to try and earn a bit of a wage.
Sadly, since the recording of this episode, Eric Harrison, the former youth coach at Manchester United, who Alan cited as a major inspiration, has passed away. Gives me great pleasure to welcome to Humans XS Manchester a man who at the age of just 14 became the first footballer to be signed to Manchester United by Alex Ferguson. Tragically, his football career ended just 10 years later, aged 24, following a devastating back injury. Since then, he's earned himself a PhD in football psychology and he's become an ambassador for Mental Health FA, or Mental Health First Aid. Alan Tong, welcome to Humans XS Manchester.
Thank you, Clint.
And you'll be the first footballer that we've had on.
Absolutely privileged to be here and come on and speak to you. Thanks for inviting me in.
You're a great first footballer to have. I dare say there'll be others along the way, but your story is quite unique and it's not your usual football story. Let's start right at the beginning first of all. You're born in Bury, yeah?
That's right, yeah. Fairfield Hospital.
Yeah, it's still there, isn't it?
It is. Still knocking about. 1972, so quite a long time ago.
Right.
I always laugh that, you know, when you're applying for stuff now, like you have to put details into somewhere. It's always a worry when the year's getting like longer and longer, you know, when you get on the click down list.
I'm 1959, man. It takes me a lot longer than you to get to mine.
Yeah, really.
So it's very childhood then. What are your memories, first memories of growing up in Bury?
Yeah, you know, I think very, very football, Clint. Driven from a young age. My dad, big United supporter, you know, United daft. And he always used to tell me about some of the tales of the top players back then. You know, your besties, your Dennis Laws, Bobby Charltons, and going back even further to, you know, the Busby Babes. And I kind of, like a lot of families, I guess that was kind of passed on down the generations to myself. I can always remember like a ball at my feet and, you know, my dad put some goals in the garden for me and things like that. So I guess quite a strong football identity from a really early age, which kind of sort of, you know, progressed on into playing for teams and local Saturday sides, Sunday sides, and then managed to get into my Bolton schoolboy team, represented Greater Manchester County, and then got scouted for United eventually.
Were you into music as well back then?
Yeah, broad range of stuff, you know. Always used to sort of, my dad was again a big music lover, sort of passed on, so used to remember listening to things like the Hollies and the Beatles, Rolling Stones. That was kind of my dad's favourite bands, and yeah, you know, that was kind of passed on to myself as well. So as opposed to specific music, Clint, I quite broad, really. Yeah. Quite a broad interest across all ages and all disciplines.
But you always had your eye on being a footballer, even as a kid.
Yeah, love playing football. You know, this is kind of going back into the days where you remember like the cup finals as being a brilliant family day. You know, if you weren't fortunate enough to get a ticket, it was back in the day where the final had probably, or the tele coverage had start in the morning.
Yeah.
And it'd kind of follow some of the players and you'd see them having breakfast and you'd see them getting onto the coach and stuff like that. And so I had warm memories of that. One good memory, one bad memory. Great memory for me was United when they won the cup in 77. They stopped Liverpool doing the treble that year.
Yeah.
But then a couple of years later, 79, Arsenal done us in the last minute with, you know, an Alan Sunderland sort of winner. So that probably your older listeners will remember that. But again, going through the 80s, remember 83, I think we beat Brighton, 85 Everton, Norman Whiteside scored. So it's all those, remembering all those sort of highs and sort of aligning yourself and hoping that one day you'd get the opportunity to maybe be in that position.
And you did, because some of those people you mentioned back then, you literally played alongside Bobby Charlton at one point. We'll come to that in a minute too. But I remember that through the 60s and 70s, like, so when it was cup final day, the country just stopped, didn't it? It was like a royal wedding, wasn't it? Every time it was a cup final.
There were special days and you know, great warm memories from your childhood and those sort of things. And because it brings the family together and it's like, you get all the coverage. More often than not, it was a sunny afternoon at Wembley and, yeah, you know, great memories from stuff like that. And I think in the modern day, Clint, it's kind of more commercialised now. You know, you get a lot of the cup finals and it's all about the jazz and you get, you know, singers beforehand and stuff, yeah, like that and all sorts going on. And more often than not, I think they're like R5 kickoffs now, where it used, yeah, to be like 3 o'clock back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, and there's a lot of money involved now, isn't there, these days, which there wasn't back then, was there? No. How'd you go on at school? Did you do all right as a kid?
Enjoyed my schooling. You know, I did quite well. Primary school, got, you know, good reports. I always kind of had, following my football career, I'd like quite a strong academic identity as well, whereas, you know, I did all right at my GCSE, so I wasn't unusual back then, I think, heading into a football club at 16 full time,
yeah,
with a decent amount of qualifications around me.
Very unusual. And it's like kids that were focusing on music when I was at school, they did crap academically, mm-hmm, but some of us did all right in music.
Yeah, yeah.
So you ended up at Bolton Lads Club. How old were you then when you joined
them? Bolton Lads Club,
I think it was
under 14s I started with Bolton, and probably one of the best times that I had in my football, and that was only because the coach that I had at that time was unbelievably supportive. He used to sort of, you know, he used to encourage me to get on the ball. I was on all the free kicks, I was on all the corners, and, you know, just every sort of thing I did, he was very praiseworthy of me. And I think, you know, from a personality perspective, I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed that bit of, I think everybody does, Clint, don't they enjoy that sort of, that backing?
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know if you remember, it was an old player who used to play for Man City called Paul Molden.
I remember that name.
Yeah, back in the 80s. And it was his dad, Tony, who was the coach back then. And a fantastic man. And Tony got a lot of warm memories of him in relation to my football experiences. You know, you remember great coaches. He was fantastic for me.
And like you said, some of your fondest memories back then, because life was pretty free of pressure, wasn't it?
It was.
Whereas
it
when
was.
You ended up at United, you're suddenly part of this big machine, which we're going to come to in a minute or two. When did you first hear that Alex Ferguson was keeping an eye on you?
Yeah, well, what happened back then, Clive, we used to notice scouts coming to games, and it was an old scout back then for United called George Knight, who used to follow the Bolton area. And used to notice George on Sunday mornings, or he'd follow the Bolton schoolboys on a Saturday morning. And it was kind of, I think it was not, it wasn't an instant, oh, we'll take you, come on trial. It was, I think it was kind of watching me for a little while. Mm. And the moment I remember, I think I was playing for Greater Manchester County on Macclesfield Town's ground. I can't remember the opposition, but it was a fella called Joe Brown who came watching, and Joe was the youth development officer at that time. And then following that, I think he approached my mum and dad after that match and said we'd like to invite Alan down to United on trial.
Wow, what a moment.
Oh, incredible, yeah. You know, almost a dream coming true, really. You know, yeah. United, we're all United supporters in the family. So that was an incredible time and something that gives you, you know, a lot of warm memories thinking about it.
I bet you didn't sleep that night, did you?
Tossing and turning, dreaming of scoring winners in cup finals, I think, at that stage. So, yeah.
So you joined then, you were 14, you joined United on a, did they call it a schoolboy contract?
That's right, Clint, yeah. Signed schoolboy forms back then. So how it worked is I used to go down to the Cliff in Lower Broughton on a, I think we trained on a Monday night and a Thursday night from something like 6 till 8. And then usually, my first representative side at United was playing in something called the B team. Right. So they used to have four teams back then. First team, reserves, A and B. So anybody sort of around the schoolboy age has started off in the B team and then hopefully progress you through the sides.
Try and paint us a little picture of your day-to-day at United, because it wasn't just about the football. They had you doing jobs and that, didn't they?
Yeah, it was.
Decorating and that.
It was. It was a very different culture, you know, and I think something, Clint, that shocked me a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, you have these sort of, these visions and this imagery of it like being almost like a football factory where you're just pinging balls across the cliff every morning and everything's rosy, but it was tough culture.
Yeah.
You know, you had to clean boots, we had to sweep dressing rooms. Like you say, we was painting training grounds. United had another training ground alongside the cliff called Littleton Road or Ayrshire Road.
Yeah.
So we used to have to go, you know, get on the tractor and spray sand and, you know, with your spades and stuff like that. So it wasn't as glamorous. It wasn't as glamorous as maybe it is certainly today. You know, it's changed a lot over this last 20, 25 years.
It sounds like child labour, doesn't it?
It is. I didn't expect to be going to United training and coming back with all paint on my tracksuit and stuff like that. So.
And what was Ferguson like to work with back then?
Tough man, a winner, disciplined, good experience from Sir Alex. He kind of, I think the club back then, Clint, was a bit different because when Sir Alex took over, they were almost in a transition period. They were in the midst of this. They've not won the league for many, many years. And I think that was the objective of him. But that took time. Mm. You know, I think Sir Alex joined November 86 and I think they didn't win a trophy till 1990. And, you know, in modern football, I'm not sure if you'd get four seasons to do that.
You wouldn't get a couple of weeks, don't you?
Exactly. So, you know, you hear a manager's getting sacked after like 3 months or, you know, even less than that. So I think it was almost like a rebuilding period at that time. And, you know, I always joke, Clint, to my mum and dad, if they'd have waited a couple of years, I might have been in with that class of 92.
But yeah, well, you weren't far off, were you?
No, a couple of years behind him.
Yeah.
So
Giggs was on your team, wasn't he, at that point?
He was.
Yeah.
He, again, outstanding. I think the first time I saw Ryan, about 14 years old, I'd turned up to the Cliff training ground to train with Eric Harrison back then. And Ryan was in like a couple of year groups below me, so they had the earlier slot. And I remember Eric Harrison coming over to his group. I think it was a group of 14, 15-year-olds and saying, see that kid over there? It's only like a little spindly, thin, you know, kid at the time. And he said, he's going to be some player. And for me as a 14, 15, it didn't mean a lot at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't know what's coming tomorrow, never mind what's going to happen in 5, 6 years. But he wasn't wrong, Eric, was he?
That's
you know, incredible. Ryan was an unbelievable professional.
What were the wages like back then? I mean, did you get a wage as a teenager? Was it a payment?
Sometimes things happen in circles, Clint, where things kick in again. We was on like the old apprentice scheme that you may remember called the YTS.
YTS,
so that. my first year's wage at United was astonishing, £28.50 a week. And I used to get, I think it was £6 a week bus pass, something like that, to get me to the cliff and back from where I lived.
And what were the full-timers getting then, the main players?
Yeah,
what were they being getting?
I'd probably say that they were probably on maybe, you know, your top-paid players, I'd say, let me think, probably maybe £600-800 a week, something like that. Because the only thing we got was like a bonus sheet. I remember they used to get £100 a point for winning, so £300. But if you look at some of the figures these days, I don't know, like, what, £800, you know, how far it'd go in a footballer's world.
It might buy you the actual ball at the play. Do you find yourself exasperated when you look at how much money is involved in modern football and how it's changed the old everything about the game? Do you find it a bit sad?
I think there's been a massive shift in relation to that, Clint. I think football, to me, has always been entrenched in the working classes. And I think that, you know, when I used to go on trial and play at United, more often than not in the car park, you'd see fruit and veg vans or, you know, older cars. But these days, you tend to go into, like, academy car parks and there's Range Rovers in there and BMW. I think with all the money that's been sort of ploughed into the game, maybe the working classes have kind of been detached from that a little bit. Even affording to go to the games is expensive, you know, and you read about these lads getting £300,000 a week, £400,000 a week, but ticket prices never seem to get reduced, or the fans always seem to suffer, which I think it's got to maybe try and level that up a little bit. Will it happen? I'm not sure.
It's hard to retain any element of soul in it, or something like they call it the beautiful game, obviously. It's been the beautiful game for so long. It was always going to happen that the money men were going to start getting involved at some point, and here we are, but hopefully it won't destroy the spirit of the game too much. You also got to meet Sir Matt Busby, didn't you, several times?
Fantastic in memories again. You know, Sir Matt used to come and watch some of the youth games. So how it used to work, Clint, back then, is youth games would probably happen in the morning, say 11 o'clock kickoff on the cliff or Littleton Road if he was in the A team or the B team. And more often than not, Sir Alex had come and have a look, and Sir Bobby had turn up, and Sir Matt used to come and have a look as well. And he was lucky enough to, Sir Matt joined us on a tour. We went to Switzerland in something called the Blue Star Tournament, and Sir Matt Busby had an affinity with that because he'd been taking the Busby Babes there years before. And remember Sir Matt coming and just almost in awe of these people, Clint, a little bit frightened of the man, really, not in a nasty way, but just because of the power and the esteem that he had. And I remember one evening we were sat in the foyer in the hotel playing cards and just having a mingle with some of the players, and sort of saw Sir Matt edging over. And he said, "Okay, boys," you know, in that gravelly, he had a gravelly sort of Bells Hill tone. And you said, like, we're a bit frightened, like I said, and said, yeah, not so bad. Good, Sir Matt, thank you. He said, as long as you're enjoying yourself, that's the main thing. And I thought that philosophy must have been in his teams.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
And tell us about the time he played alongside Bobby Charlton on the actual same team as Bobby.
Yeah, well, again, that was incredible. That was at Blue Star again, Clint. And what had happened is we'd finished the tournament and we had, I think it was a Brazilian side called Botafogo. And a representative of Botafogo had come to see a United rep and said, is there any chance we can have you play your friendly tomorrow? Well, we weren't going home till sort of the day after that. So, you know, yeah, okay, not a problem. And they said, we'd be really privileged if Sir Bobby played. So thinking, Sir Bobby must have been about 50 or 60 on at the time. you're thinking to yourself, you know, surely he can't run. It was unbelievable.
He could still do it.
Oh, he was knocking 25-yard passes, short passes, whistling shots over the bar. I think he scored one of the goals. And I always think to myself, crikey, what must have you have been like in your prime, you know, like if he can still do that with a group of under-18s. Mm. Yeah, running the show. So, what a memory.
What would your highlight be of your footballing career? There was one moment that you could cherish for the rest
of the days. Yeah, I think probably signing. I think when they offered, United offered me and said, we're going to give you like schoolboy forms, and they offered me like an apprenticeship with it. I can recall going into flying into my home on that evening, like telling my mum was there because my dad was at work, and just like, United want to sign me. Mm. So that's very warm. But I think one of the probably, if anybody asks you what's the highlight, I'd probably say something a bit different. I'd probably say in getting back up from the disappointment, because I got a real blow at 19 when, you know, Sir Alex had said to me, we don't feel as though you're progressing enough to be a candidate for the first team. You know, I'd been on the been in reses and I'd played in a couple of first team friendlies, but I couldn't quite get that next step into the first team squad. And it was like, heartbroken, Clint, because, you know, you'd done all that training and playing and putting your heart and soul into something, and then you just get a slap in the chops then, unfortunately, and, you know, left to pick up the pieces.
There's a lot of parallels with musicians. I said this to you before we started recording today, that a lot of bands go through it. My band went through it. One minute we were doing Top of the Pops and headlining festivals. Next minute we had no record deal and I was signing on. So there's a lot of parallels with it, but like you say, you just fight through it and come back even stronger and better. So it was 1991, wasn't it? You moved to Exeter City.
That's right, yeah. So again, a bit strange. You know, you say in your career, Man United to Exeter sometimes doesn't go hand in hand, those two clubs, but it come via Alan Ball, who's an old, like, 66 winner, World Cups. He was a manager of a party or a representative game that I'd played in while I was at United. I got represented to go and play for the Football League 11 in Russia, in Moscow, and it was Alan Ball and a lad called Laurie McMenemy at the time who took the party. And then when United and were not working out, Bawley sort of got wind of that, and he invited me down to there. So I remember he had a little Ford Fiesta at the time, and you're thinking to yourself, Exeter's not on your doorstep. it's quite a long trip down there, and yeah. You know, we speak about two different cultures, like Manchester and Exeter. You know, Manchester more, you know, driven music scene, more hustle and bustle, and Exeter quite a quaint, quiet little place. So again, bit of a cultural adaptation took place then, but I really enjoyed my time there. You know, I'd had a few great seasons, managed to get into the first team, and I was just getting my career back on track again when another slap in the chops happened and got a bad injury.
Was it the injury that caused the back problems? I know it started with tingling sensations in your arms and got worse from there. So tell us how that all came about.
Well, again, it's difficult. You know, a lot of lads who go down the lower leagues will probably resonate with this, in that you don't get as long as contracts as some of the elite level players. You know, like you hear elite level players, they sign 4 and 5 year deals, whereas you go down the food chain a bit and it's almost like 1 year and 2 year deals. And I was kind of, I think first of all, I got given a 1 year deal, and then I got through that, and then I got offered a 2 year deal, but well into that, I kind of started getting pins and needles in my feet and my arms, but I was stupid. Like, I don't know why I did this, but I was maybe just thinking to myself, if I can get over it, I can get another contract, and at least I'm a bit more settled. I always had that worry in the back of my mind, so I played with this for maybe a few weeks more than I should have done. But it got to a stage where I just couldn't, you know, I was struggling to pull my socks on, and I thought, I'm going to have to see the physio and report this. And he said, he'll send you for a scan. My bottom of my spine was kind of out of alignment. I needed screws and plates in there, and I started on the process of quite a big rehabilitation program. And you know, it come sort of 6 months, 9 months later, I had a word with surgeon. He said, I think it might be worth having a look at, you know, taking some insurance money and looking for, you know, another opportunity somewhere else. Your football career is coming to an end.
Yeah, so you stepped out of it.
Yeah.
And what was the immediate period after that like for you personally?
Yeah, lost. Mm. Yeah, I was very lost for, I'd say, let me think here, 24 years, probably about 4 years. Clint lost, went through a series of jobs doing different things, you know, working in warehouses. I was working for the post office, signed up with agencies, stuff like that. Yeah. So anything to try and earn a bit of a wage. And then I kind of got to 28 years old, and I thought, well, I was reasonably academic at school. You know, Man United at the time, when I joined them as an apprentice, had put me through a college course. So I had that in my back pocket. And I used that to go and start a sports science degree at the University of Bolton. So I decided to re-engage with my education.
Yeah.
And I think funny sort of situation, really, because it's almost like you're going back to 18 again. You know, like most people have done their A-levels and they start a degree. But I was 28 going back to 18, so it's like, you know, but I had to step back to go forwards again, or else, you know, I'm not too sure where I would have been at the moment.
It's funny, that period of your life there coincides exactly to the years, like 96, 97, to the period when I was on my ass big time. I was in a different part of Manchester than you. I was in Rochdale. But it's exactly the same. Exactly the same. You're in this the pit, the, you know, the lowest point you've ever had in your working life. So what do? You either roll over and die, or you just fight your way out of it, which is what you did and what I did as well. So well done to you.
And like you say, Clint, I think I remember having to go and sign on for a little period and seeing a lad who I used to go to school with in sort of the benefits office and you know, and it's not shame, it's not embarrassment, but you feel that at the time because they, you know, they'd known you through the school and, as you know, Alan Tong, strong football identity,
Manchester
apprentice
United.
At United, pro at United, got assigned a pro deal at United, and it's tough, isn't it? It's like you say, you plummet very quickly to the bottom of that greasy pole. But like you say, I think what makes me most proud, I suppose, was picking ourselves back up again, Clinton, and moving forwards.
Because back then, you couldn't turn around to somebody and say, yeah, I need a bit of therapy on this. I'm in a bad place here. that support wasn't there, was
no,
it? And
it,
even
it
to the point where your close mates had not always relate to how you're feeling about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You know, they'd assume you got shitloads of money in the bank, you and me, which we didn't. So I went on and started writing more songs and formed another silly band and that, but you went on and did your further education thing. Did you sort of feel, was that a therapeutic thing or was it a career sort of driven decision?
Well, I think like a lot of students, you know, you kind of start your programme and you go for this degree in sports science and, you know, because I've got a broad interest in sport, you know, not just football. I like golf. I follow most things on Sky. If there's boxing on, I'll watch that. If there's horse racing on, I'll watch that. You know, a broad range of stuff. So I thought if I could find a job in sport, you know, that would be the ideal. But I went a couple of years into my degree and was still unsure, you know, where I was headed. And I think it was just maybe a bit of inspiration and watching some of the lecturers in action and thinking to myself, you know, with a bit of training and a bit of mentoring and a bit of guidance, I could probably be quite good at that. You know, I'd been in dressing rooms with players, so I understood banter, I understand unity, working together.
Injuries
and a whole range of sports stuff. So it's kind of sort of, like we say, it's bending that disappointment then into a sort of an opportunity to move your life on again, and that's where it came from, really. And since I did my degree, I'd done a teacher training qualification straight away after. I've done a master's degree in philosophy, and as you said, you know, I'm sort of a stone's throw from getting my PhD over the line as well. And I think sort of re-engaging with that education has given me a little bit of purpose and meaning again.
Let's talk about, I mentioned an entity before, Adrian Doherty, who was a United player that you played directly alongside. In fact, you photographed by his side, aren't you? One of the team pictures. A young chap who sadly no longer with us, but he was hailed as being probably one of the greatest since George Best and never got a chance to see his full potential. He got injured too young, he died too young. Tell us about Adrian, I want to talk about him. Fascinating story.
Well, Adrian was a little Irish lad that's like you say, Clint played in the same youth teams as I did, and outstanding ability. Like I say, he was a little right winger. He had pace, he had trickery, he had skills, and quite different from your stereotypical footballer, Adrian. He had quite a broad identity. I think he had a complex identity. He used to like Bob Dylan. He used to like philosophy. He used to read about all different psychologists. And
he used to go busking on Market Street in Manchester.
Incredible story that.
Yeah,
I think that. You know, United back then, Clint, they used to give you two complimentary tickets for games. And, you know, he wouldn't tout them or anything like that. Or it's not about making money, but he just found more interest and meaning than going singing The Times They Are a-changing in Manchester City Centre than going watching the first team play at that time. And you think to yourself, you know, imagine a United apprentice or a scholar doing that in the modern day. And it's kind of difficult to comprehend, but. But he, like you say, I think at the time he was rated on a parallel as Ryan. You know, Ryan was outstanding as a youngster, but I think Adrian was close to first team debut as well.
Even Ryan says he probably was slightly better than Ryan.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and to get that praise off someone like Ryan is unbelievable, really. But again, like you say, Clint, this kind of, for all the glory and all the sort of the success and the superstardom that some lads get, there's tucked under there, you know, there's your disappointing stories as well. And like you said, I think he was just allowed to drift out of football, really, Eddie. I think he ended up working at a chocolate factory in Preston, and I think he was over in Holland, in Amsterdam, where I think he got a job in a furniture place. But he was free-spirited. He used to just turn up and he's gone working in Holland, or he's working at a chocolate factory, or he's doing this, he's doing that. And he fell into a canal going to work or coming away from work. And obviously it might have been early in the morning, nobody around, and you know, went into a coma and sadly lost his life. I think it was a day before either his 27th or 28th birthday, something like that.
27.
So, yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? That parallel universe, it is out there somewhere, and Adrian Doherty will be like the Beckham in that world, won't he? Yeah. And you'll be right outside of him as well, won't
he? That's nice. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Let's talk about the Mental Health FA. When I first saw this, I thought it was something to do with the Football Association.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with it. It's Mental Health First Aid.
Yeah.
Tell us about what that charity does and your involvement with it.
Yeah, well, it was a lad called Colin Dolan, and he approached, I think he emailed me, and he said he's looking to get a few footballers. I think Neville Southall's involved with it, and a couple of lads who have played in the past, and just to promote some of the work they did. They work a lot in the community. And I think as we stand, I mentioned to you before, Clint, he's trying to get some money raised at the moment to take a group of young footballers who've had mental health issues and problems over to Italy to play in a five-a-side tournament. So he's on Twitter as Colin Dolan, and he just asked me to try and promote some of the stuff that they do, because, you know, we're in a crisis, aren't we? Like a world crisis at the moment with mental health, anxiety, depression. There's a whole range of different issues associated with that. And I think we're getting a little bit more understanding of it. We're getting a more appreciative of, you know, people have different issues. And I think that really, really needs to keep getting pushed. And hopefully we can, you know, maybe get some happier people one day.
It can only get better. It's like I said, we're fortunate that we have in an age where issues like mental health are talked about and embraced and generally understood, more so than any other time in human history.
Yeah.
So it takes something devastatingly shit to stop that forward movement, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
And I reckon that our football social people here at XS, I reckon that we've got enough followers that follow the station, that love football, that we can make up that other 1,500 quid this
will help
with
that.
Tell us about your life now then. Have you got kids?
Yeah, two children. My daughter's up at Newcastle University, Clinton, at the moment. She's coming to the end of her studies, so she's done a degree in English, so very proud of her. My son, unfortunately, had a little bit of a knockback a month or two ago. He was with Oldham for a season or two, and unfortunately they've said to him that, you know, they felt he wasn't quite good enough to get awarded a scholarship, but he's gone into a little development group at Bolton Wanderers at the moment, so I think he's eyeing up his next steps in relation to, I think a lot of clubs these days do, you play and train for a few days a week, but you do a college course around it as well. I think it's all based in the ground at Bolton, so we went on a little open day a few weeks ago, and he's got an interview coming up for that.
Right.
So mate, you never know, he might follow in my footsteps and have a little try at football, you know, but I always say to him, you know, just enjoy it as much. I wish people would say that to me, enjoy it as much as you can, because there's highs in there, of course there is, but there's lots of lows to fight off as well, and like life, I suppose.
People buy into passion. I find that with a lot of what I do. I'm not great at any of the things that I do, but I'm passionate about all of them, and that's why people buy into it, innit? And football's the same, innit?
Yeah.
Do you still support the team then? Do you still follow United?
Yeah, still get there every so often. You know, I'm not a season ticket. I think most of my Saturday have been taken up following my son Sam around for the last sort of few years, so... But I try to get in when I can, and, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be involved with the Ex-Players Association as well. They have a few events. I think it's about four events a year, a couple of golf days, and again, all raising money for charity, which is fantastic. And I always love talking to the old lads, you know, like lads like your Alex Dawsons and Carlos Satoris, and they're very humble, you know. Yeah. Football was a very, very different time back in that era. I think what they do worry about, though, Clint, is the future of the association. A lot of the modern players don't seem to want to engage with it, because, you know, if you have a look at the CVs of most of them, they kind of come to United for a few seasons and they're going off somewhere else. And, you know, an ex-players association maybe doesn't hold as much clout in the modern day as it used to do.
Right.
So I think they're a bit concerned about that. So if there's any younger members who want to get involved with it to keep it alive, you know, jump on side and contact Alan Wardle or Jimmy Elms. They're like the treasurers and the people who run the association.
You mentioned your lad being a footballer then. I bet because of what you've gone through, and you being, obviously, you're going to be a mentor because you're his dad.
Yeah.
I bet he's got the academic backup in case the football thing doesn't happen.
Yeah, we push that. Absolutely. So, again, from experience and learning, I think for any young footballer, it's important to not put all your eggs in one basket. You know, I think that's where the problems come. If you just think, I am a footballer and nothing else, a bit like you mentioned, Clint, about musicians, if I am a musician and nothing else, and it doesn't work out, you know, what's your backup plan? Yeah. Where are you going after that?
You've just got some great stories to tell.
Yeah, it's absolutely right.
What advice do you give then to youngsters? I mean, you've probably done it there. One would be have a backup plan, and two, enjoy it.
All I'd say, Clint, is don't get too far ahead of yourself. I was saying about the... I think some parents now, your kid gets invited in for a trial, which is brilliant. That's only the first step on a very long journey. And I feel sometimes parents get like 10,000 miles into the future, and you think, he's only 12, she's only 12. You know, they've got a long journey yet. And I think some of the parents think, like, he's going to be the next superstar, or he's going to be earning 20 grand a week by the time he's 17. And, you know, that's not the right thing. I think you've got to enjoy your football, embrace every day, and embrace the experiences that you get as well. You know, I think that's one thing that I didn't do enough, is almost be patient and just enjoy it at the time. It was always like looking ahead to the next thing, and then when you're out of it, you cash your mind back and you think, I just wish I'd have been a little bit more patient then and embrace it and enjoyed it a bit more. So that would be my advice.
Yeah. You come across as still being a very proud Mancunian. You consider yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, represented the county. Like I say, very, very strong associations with United through my dad and through my little spell there. And very lucky to play with some greats. You know, I've not come away from football from the financial elements because you can't really buy a Porsche on £28.50 a week, like, can you? but memories are, you know, memories are my pillows, as it were. You know, I've got, like, played with some great players. Brian Robson, Norman Whiteside, Giggsy, Gordon Strachan, Stevie Bruce, Paul McGrath, you know. Yeah. Great memories. But not only that, like, some of the apprentice lads were good as well. I still keep in contact with lads like Giuliano Maiorana, who was there for a spell. It's like, it is very much like the army sometimes. You battle away and you work together and you sweat together, but then you don't see people for ages.
Yeah.
But then when you meet up with them again, there's always that, I think, that level of respect to think, you know, what you're up to now and what you're doing and do you remember Eric Harrison?
It's exactly the same as the musicians, when it's like the old Manchester bands, whenever we bump into each other, all the anecdotes. And we've all got the same battle scars.
Absolutely.
Still breathing, fortunately.
Yeah.
If I was to say to you, Alan, give me the names of two or three humans of excess Manchester, two, three important people, either from Manchester or people who've contributed to the city.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, Clint, it's all about, I always believe that if you go through your life's journey so far, you almost get at different points of that journey outstanding people, I think, in your life, and that goes right back into your schooling, you know, primary school, coaches, managers, and then, you know, even academics. Now, my PhD is being mentored by Mark Nesty, and Mark is one of the few people to have worked in the Premier League as a sports psychologist. So you get a lot of sports psychologists, but they tend to work with the academies or the youngsters. Mark's been in with the first team lads, so, you know, he's a brilliant academic. So to meet someone like that's fantastic. And, you know, like I've mentioned throughout the sort of podcast, you know, primary school teachers, Mr. Matt Faddian, I remember, is a great man. Tony Molden, my coach. You know, a little bit Sir Alex and Eric, a little bit of stuff there, but maybe not as much as some of these other guys that I've met.
Yeah.
So I'd probably say that primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, coaches, and my, you know, my academics that I've kind of met, they're kind of the ones that have been most inspirational for me.
Before you go, Alan, describe Manchester in three words.
Manchester in three words. I think the first one I've got to say is United, but not in the Old Trafford sort of United, in the togetherness.
The small
U. I'll go United. I'll go with spirit as well. And I'll go with passion. Let's go with passion, Clint, I think.
Alan Tong, thank you for being a human of excess Manchester.
Thank you, Clint, so much.
That was Alan Tong. Make sure you join us next week, where I'll be speaking to Colin Gibbons, Factory Records enthusiast and the owner of everything the Manchester label ever released. Don't forget to follow us on social media, subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester, rate us, and feel free to leave us a review. We love getting your feedback. Thanks for listening. See you next week.